Hey folks, welcome back to So-Called Normal. I'm Mark Hennick. This is a little normal, a little bite-sized episode that we're doing in between our five limited series episodes exploring complex treatment pathways for treatment-resistant depression. You know, how do people actually interface with a system that is poorly designed, to say the least, to try to get themselves help? And this is something that we heard from our upcoming episode, my conversation with Natasha, this idea of self-help. How do you not only advocate for yourself, but how do you do the work, as we say in the profession? So I'm going to bring in Dave Trafford. Dave's my editor and co-producer on the show and most of the past 60 episodes of this show. Dave, how are you?
I'm well. And just for the record, just because it's a shorter version, it's not less normal than what we have
it's
done.
It's not less normal. It's just a little bite-sized normal.
Right.
I came up with this. Maybe this won't even make the final cut. I don't know. We came up with this in our first chat. I came up with this in my first chat, as I often do, to call it a little normal. But it is just a little slice of heaven, I guess.
Well, we'll settle it.
Yeah, okay.
Well,
you don't have to be so dodgy. Anyway, this idea, I want to talk to you about this idea of self-help, because I think it's certainly been key in my experience. Now, I want to even be hesitant in saying the word self-help, because that almost feels like a trademarked term that refers to the quote-unquote self-help industry or the wellness industry. I don't think that's actually what it means, but that's what it's been. That's what it comes to mean. I think it evokes an image in people's minds. So, what comes to mind to you when I say self-help?
Well, I think that's it. That's this big motivational speech that somebody's going to give you, and as my daughter Erin would tell you, you'd go into the woo-woo of the conversation, and it gets a little, you know, wacky at times. But there's something at the center of it that, and I've heard you talk about this in the course of your conversations, is that what's important through all of this is to take care of yourself, and in so doing, there's the essence of the self-help. And so there's a level of awareness that comes with that, or it requires, I guess, and the notion that that this, as you point out, is work. It's not something that is, in fact, going to be you're going to read the book, you're going to be fine. You're going to take the pill, you're going to be fine. That, in fact, in these circumstances, it does require commitment and, to some degree, some courage to move this thing forward.
Well, I think there's two strands here that I want to follow on. One, this idea that you have to do the work. And I say this in, I think, every talk that I've done for the last 15 years. I tell people that you can't inject recovery into somebody, that you can't take a pill and that will recover you. That's actually something you really do have to do internally. Now, I've been one of the fortunate few that eventually I found a medication that helped me to help myself. I found great therapists who gave me skills to help myself, but no therapist was able to come in and fix my problems for me. Now, I know that people don't actually expect that, but I think at a level from people that I've worked with in the past, they kind of do in a way that they feel helpless. They feel like they've tried everything or they can't do anything for themselves because as a symptom of their illness, they have such low self-esteem. They feel like crap anyway, and they feel like they're worthless and they can't do anything anyway. So they don't get the motivation to help themselves. I think that motivation piece is actually really key.
Sure it is. And but then, you know, there's that level of confidence, though, as well. And right. Knowing that when I come to talk about it, or I require my counseling, or I'm going to have a discussion around whatever medication is required, that the individuals who are there have as much commitment to this as you do. And knowing that, I think what we heard back was that played a critical role. That relationship in there is important. So, yes, it's self-help in as much as I'm doing the work. But what I heard from Natasha is, yes, I'm doing it. I'm working hard myself. But quite frankly, you can't do it without support in a network. And I think the closing line in the podcast with her is she just talks about, listen, you know, if somebody around you is having a tough day, just be sensitive to that. Give them kindness. Be good to them, because that's what they really need. And you don't have to go into deep dive on their issues. Just be kind to each other, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I feel like people brush that off sometimes as, no, there needs to be some big scientific breakthrough. Well, no, we've been talking about melancholy and depression for millennia now, that yes, there will be big scientific breakthroughs, no question, and they will save lives. But at the end of the day, we need to do the work. We need to be kind to others, like Natasha said, because it actually does make a difference. And we know that. You know, I'm in a weird place with the self-help kind of dichotomy between the self-help industry and the practice of helping yourself, because mm-hmm. I actually happen to be a big fan of those motivational speakers who are, you know, who often have a bad reputation, I think, for preying on vulnerable people. But I think that the core of it, and there are many of those out there who do that, I should say, so, you know, you need to consume cautiously. But I think that piece around getting people together, getting them amped up, maybe, to have basic messages of kindness, of connection, of getting people to push through their barriers, I think that actually is a useful thing for people to talk about and to do, rather than just falling into this idea that everything needs to be counseling or a medical intervention of some kind. That might be part of it, but there's all this other stuff too, I think. And you know, there's this well-known idea in social work that you have to meet people where they are, that there's lots of different roads to recovery. And I'm of the view that, you know, if medication worked for you, that's awesome. If counseling worked for you, that's great. But if it was yoga that did the trick for you, or running, or painting, or whatever else, who am I to judge what worked for you in your recovery? Are you happy? That's the real question. Can you be nice to people? If the answer is yes, then that's great.
You know, as you say that, I wonder what the ripple effect has been, for example, when we've shut down places of worship that have created that level of community for some people, where that might be where they have found it, whether it was just in the community itself, whether there was something that was faith-based around it. Mm. And because we have had the community, you know, congregational part of it, you got to wonder whether or not that is going to have, we're going to see a ripple effect there as a result.
You know, that's an interesting question, because there has been a fair amount of research to suggest that people who participate in religious life of some kind do tend to report better mental health. And it doesn't seem to be related to any particular religion or the idea of religion, whatever that means, actually, but more so to, like you're saying, this congregating, this being in a community of feeling like you're part of something bigger than you, this idea of decentering, I guess, that it's not all about you and your ego, that you can break out of yourself every now and then. That is very therapeutic. But I'm not aware, actually, of anybody doing any research into the deprivation of that and how that is going to contribute to what I've been calling the coming echo pandemic. I don't even think it's coming anymore. I think it's happening. I think we're in the, mm-hmm. the mental health, mental illness wave of this pandemic now.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And you know, first episode, we were talking about getting back to community on the campuses. And that's kind of an important part of it. And one thing that struck me around Natasha's story was that, you know, she says she stops therapy as a teenager, was 16, 17 years old, something like that, and then went to university, where she kind of found herself, back to the Aiden story that we talked mm-hmm. about a couple of episodes ago. But it wasn't until she kind of had to have that focused for her, and whether it was that level of the community that did it for her, it wasn't clear, but it was interesting to me that it took that change in location and this sense of community around her, where she finally came back to, and she was diagnosed and got treatment.
You know, I've been thinking about this idea lately of what I consider to be two kind of major forms of mental illnesses. One is dislocation of sorts, that you have your baseline of how you normally feel, and usually you're okay, I guess, but then something happens, whether it's a pandemic or a job loss or a new baby's born, whatever, and it dislocates where you currently are from where you feel like you're supposed to be, right? And that's when you hear people say, after the death of a loved one, for example, I felt this after my mother died, it's not supposed to be this way. And embedded in that question, or embedded in that statement, rather, is this idea that there is another way in your mind, or another image of a different world. But then there's there seems to be this other form, though, that when people are dislocated in their mind for long enough, it's like their baseline moves down to where they are. And then suddenly sadness becomes normal, or anxiety mm-hmm. becomes normal, or really unhealthy states of mind. It's awful. It feels awful. But it's normal for you. So there's almost a less of a motivation to leave that place, because then it's uncomfortable to recover. Then it's uncomfortable that if you are happy, you start feeling like, I don't deserve to be this happy, or this is weird, I don't like this, or maybe I don't have my identity as a person with depression anymore, and that's everything to me. So I think that's a, you know, kind of, I don't know why I've been playing with these two different ideas, and I think all five people that we talked to at various points had moved their entire baseline into this identity of being a sick person. And then it was so hard to break out, because you're basically redefining what your identity as a non-sick person actually is.
Well, as you say that, it occurs to me that they were in, oddly enough, in a comfort zone. Mm-hmm. And feeling like that this was the expectation, that I should be depressed. And so taking you out of your comfort zone really was part of the...
Uncomfortable.
Right? And part of the therapy and part of the recovery. And we would think of it the other way around, I think, in most cases. It didn't occur to me until you put it that way, that as some people are going through that, this is my normal. This is my comfort zone, to feel anxiety, mm-hmm. to feel depressed. Wow. Okay. That kind of makes it, you know, frames it in such a way is that, yeah, now we got to break this to get out of it.
Yeah. But I think it's also an adaptive thing too, right? Because it's uncomfortable to be super sad or super stressed out. So mm-hmm. we adapt, we get used to it, just like we've adapted, most of us, I guess, to the pandemic, that it was uncomfortable and strange and painful at first to do the mask stuff and the social distancing. But now that we're kind of used to it, we've figured out how to do it. I think that can happen for better or worse for people. You get used to unhealthy lifestyles, and you get used to healthier lifestyles. And in between those two states, there's discomfort. And ideally, that's where the support of others comes in.
Yeah, I just, my lifestyle has been doing a lot of sitting during the COVID. So just to get up and get active, I mean, it's just that kind of thing, right? Where we have changed our routines to the point where I think it makes your point. You have choices, I think, essentially is what it is.
Well, a little normal chat is turning into a long normal chat. So let's cut this off. And we've got Natasha's episode coming up. Please subscribe to the show. Leave us a rating. Share it with your networks. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Deezer, YouTube, everywhere else. Look up So-Called Normal. Listen to the show and share it with your friends at networks. Dave, our editor and co-producer, thanks so much, as always, for coming on and chatting.
Good to be here. Thanks, Mark.
Take care.
This episode of So-Called Normal is brought to you by an educational grant from Janssen Inc. Mark Hennick and the producers of So-Called Normal are solely responsible for the content of the episode, and the views and opinions expressed in this episode do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Janssen Inc. The podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition, product, or treatment. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have read or seen in this podcast episode.